kids and stayed in constant touch with the FLDS leadership. No less alarming to me was learning about the press access that was being allowed by the FLDS. The entire religion loathed outside attention. But now the church instructed those mothers to go against their lifetime of training and actually be nice to the reporters and photographers of the Gentile media. When I heard about the decisions, I could predict with near certainty what would happen next, because it had happened before. If the FLDS women were giving interviews and providing pictures of weeping, frightened kids, the Texas operation was at risk of being a replay of the infamous 53 raid in Arizona. The FLDS propaganda machine had swung into operation with a public relations gambit that would prove to yield immense benefits for the church. Opening their secret lives to the hungry media was extremely rare, and the reporters jumped at the chance for exclusive information. Rod Parker, the longtime lawyer for the FLDS who had been fired by Warren, was back on the job, this time to help frame the church message. Although he is not a Mormon, Parker was likely very aware of the importance to the FLDS of the old 1953 Arizona raid, and how that story could be spun to match what was currently happening in Texas. Once again, the child abuse of the organization was about to be buried beneath an avalanche of media coverage, orchestrated by the claims of a twisted church and its spin doctors claiming governmental abuse. The attention of much of the country was riveted on the pictures of mothers and children. Most of the media played the story straight, but some had bought the FLDS lies. Heartless cops and government workers were snatching babies from their loving, polite, clean, and God-fearing families in defiance of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees freedom of religion. In the age of the Internet, people from all over the globe joined the conversation. That the Constitution does not give anyone permission to engage in criminal activities under the guise of religion was mostly ignored. Worshipping God is much different than raping children and breaking families apart. Chapter 35. Seizure. Bishop Merrill Jessup was out of his league. After decades of intense internal power struggles, the FLDS had abandoned any pretense of shared leadership in favor of one-man rule. Warren Jeffs made almost every decision, but in this time of ultimate crisis, he was sitting in an Arizona jail cell, and the bishop could not reach him. The police were on the doorstep of the sacred temple, and Uncle Warren was unable to call the shots. Jessup, the on-site manager, was now forced to make decisions on his own, a situation that carried serious repercussions should the prophet later believe Jessup had made the wrong choices. Jessup had to do something, because despite all of the dodges and lies, the police were connecting the dots as children and young wives were taken away for further questioning. Meanwhile, Ranger Brooks Long was putting together an expanded search warrant to supplement the original one, a section of which vividly described why things were so complicated. Long told how a CPS worker interviewed a girl named Arta Jessup Barlow, who was pregnant and had a 2-year-old child, and claimed she did not know her own age. The worker then interviewed another girl, 8-year-old Viola Barlow, who contradicted that story. Viola said that Arta had 4 children and was not even 16. According to Viola, Arta was spiritually united to Richard Jessup Barlow, who happened to be Viola's own father. The mother of Viola was Richard's first wife, Susan Black Barlow. Arta was the second wife, and both were still married to Richard. That was only one of the many convoluted stories being uncovered, tales that were strange to begin with and were further complicated by determined FLDS efforts to deceive. Ranger Long also is able to cite having personally seen a document that showed one man being married to more than 20 wives. CPS workers had interviewed a number of underage girls who were married to much older men, and some of those girls were already mothers themselves. Veda Keet had been married to Warren Jeffs at the age of 13 and had conceived her child at 14. Veda was now 19, and her daughter was 4. Around each corner, the investigators seemed to uncover a new piece of evidence that would alarm them even more, including the very notable disparity in number between males and females at the ranch. There were twice as many girls as boys. With most of what they were finding, a new warrant would not have been required because the new evidence fell under what is known as the open fields doctrine. If a peace officer observes a syringe and a spoon in the back seat of a car during a routine traffic stop for a broken taillight, he is justified in conducting a more thorough search of the vehicle to look for other evidence of a crime, unrelated to the original reason for stopping the vehicle. At the YFZ Ranch, police had crossed that legal threshold almost immediately upon entering the grounds. After 3 days of searching and uncovering fresh evidence, their probable cause was building, and with the church leaders proving untrustworthy and deceitful, it was clear that the ranch was a hotbed of criminal activity. The police were now prepared to go after the temple itself and a smaller adjoining annex, and specifically any records and data that were stored inside. Long wanted the contents of locked safes, locked desk drawers, locked vaults, computers, and computer peripherals that may contain information verifying child abuse. There was overwhelming evidence that multiple incidents of child abuse had taken place on the ranch, and a new warrant was prepared and signed by Judge Walther. This time, the FBI also showed up with a warrant of its own. Merrill Jessup was still operating under an oath to keep sacred things secret. As bishop, he probably knew what was inside the temple, and he understood that if law officers breached the inner sanctum, many of the church's most sensitive secrets would be at risk. But the doors were still locked, and while the kids and many of the women were gone by the night of April 5th, the men were still there, loyal, dedicated, ferociously faithful men who would do whatever they were told. They would resist if called upon to do so. But there was a counterbalancing force at work on Merrill Jessup, an unusual woman I will call Lorraine to respect her privacy. Lorraine had been a wife of the late prophet Rulon Jeffs. After his death, she was hounded by Warren to become another one of his wives, but she refused and left the church. She still maintained close ties to many of the people within the religion, people she had known her whole life, and was anxious to help if she could. She had been invited to go to Texas to stand by as a sort of cultural translator and help shed light on some of the religious practices and family histories. When things began to heat up at the temple site, Lorraine remembered that she still had the bishop's number in her phone. As tensions escalated, she made the decision to try to contact and reason with the only man that had the authority to avert violence. To her surprise, Merrill Jessup answered the call. He did not want to talk to her, but Lorraine was persistent, and he was so desperate for guidance that he reluctantly listened. Lorraine became a calming voice as the crisis unfolded, urging Merrill to carefully think through this potentially dangerous situation and not do anything rash. "Don't let it turn ugly," she said. Since Uncle Warren was not around, Merrill felt reasonably safe talking to Lorraine, and her warning carried some weight, whether he wanted to admit it or not. As the cops prepared to enter the temple, the behavior of the FLDS men took on a more menacing tone. They spread out until one of them was positioned every 16 feet or so along the perimeter of the wall that surrounded the 5-acre temple property. They would periodically hold their arm to the square and pray loudly for God to bring down whirlwind judgments upon the heads of the police, the defilers, and strike them dead. Dozens of harmonized, deep voices were begging for the Lord to intervene and punish the unbelievers. The police cleared a path through the chanting men, who stood their ground and simply would not get out of the way. the cops wrestled a huge battering ram into position at the temple's massive oak front door, and the FLDS prayers for death turned into hymns, with a defiant all-male chorus singing old Mormon songs of faith. The chant of the hymn, "The Spirit of God," rang out as the battering ram smashed against the big door with a booming, cannon-like thunder. The ram was so heavy that officers had to take turns handling it, and the doors were so thick and sturdy that it took police more than an hour to break through. All the while, the FLDS men sang out and prayed, chanting for the destruction of the officers, their voices rising like a demented choir. Even some longtime policemen and Texas Rangers were shaken by the unrelenting calls for divine intervention. "Really weird," observed one. When the door eventually cracked, the watchers moaned in shock and dismay. The battering continued, and soon a second crack appeared, which increased the calls for God to rain down the ultimate punishment on the intruders. When the ram made a third large split, the 12-foot doors flew apart with an echoing boom, and the entrance to the cavernous temple was finally breached. All around the wall, the men of the church collapsed like marionettes whose strings had been cut. Some dropped to their knees in disbelief. Others fell prone and scrabbled in the dirt, and still others stood sobbing like children with their faces buried in their hands. Loud, agonized cries ripped the air, the sound of shattered faith. Through a life of conditioning, the men immediately accepted their own blame. It was their own unworthy thoughts and actions that had precluded God's direct intervention from saving their temple. In response to other failures, such as when predictions for the end of the world had failed to materialize, the prophet had always preached they were at fault, being unfit for the Lord's use. Now, once again, the prophet himself, already in prison, would have to magnanimously shoulder the blame and suffer and atone even more for the sins of his slothful followers. Most of the police felt sorry for the wailers, but there was no time to waste. They fanned out into teams for the temple search. The search was long and tedious, and each room from the basement to the Holy of Holies on the top floor had to be scoured for forensic evidence. The Rangers had received intelligence from former members that secret passageways and hidden rooms were common in FLDS buildings, so the search meticulously plodded along in case something had been overlooked. Finally, one tired Ranger went into an office and, when he saw nothing unusual, leaned against a large bookshelf. He felt it give a little. He recalled the briefing about hidden rooms in other FLDS compounds, and so he began to push and shove. Then his fingers felt a latch, and when he freed it, the bookshelf came away from the wall. Behind it was a large door constructed of heavy oak with steel security locks. The door led into a hidden underground passage with more, still heavier doors blocking the path. Along the way, Rangers discovered empty gun safes, and tensions escalated considerably. Trained dogs would later be brought in to sniff around the property, and they located a cargo container buried beneath the home of Isaac Jeffs, the prophet's brother, containing 33 weapons stashed inside. Pistols, Israeli military industry-made weapons, military-style Bushmaster AR-15s, and even a powerful Barrett 50-caliber sniper rifle with a precision Unertal scope. All were legally registered. A cop who looked at the arsenal gave a low whistle and said, "They could have held us off for a month with this stuff." Maybe having the cover of an armored personnel carrier as backup had not been a bad idea at all. Meanwhile, the underground search had turned up some interesting file cabinets and the suspicious gun storage lockers, but no smoking gun. Continuing through the corridor, they moved into the area at which the temple was connected to the smaller temple annex and discovered the final door. A bank-grade Class 1 Hamilton safe door with a thickness of more than 18 inches of solid steel. The foundation walls were 4 feet thick and also were reinforced with steel, and together with the door, they provided a nearly impenetrable barrier. Whatever was behind all of that was well protected. Professional locksmiths were stymied. Workers hacked at the thick concrete beside the door, trying to create a hole, before realizing they would need specialized equipment to break through. Trucks bearing heavy-duty drills of the sort used on oil rigs were summoned, and roughnecks came along to operate them. A drill was set up outside the annex building, and the roughnecks began grinding through the foundation at a spot identified on a blueprint. The crews underground inside and the crews outside above ground worked simultaneously, and the outside group finally punched a small hole that they managed to widen enough so that a very small man might make it inside. Ranger Sergeant Jesus Valdez, small to begin with, made himself even smaller by removing most of his clothes. Then, armed with a flashlight and his pistol, he wiggled in. The thick foundations had blocked radio contact between the two teams, and when the drillers from inside broke through a short time later, they were totally surprised to look in and find Jesus Valdez in the vault looking back at them. Their first thought was that maybe the FLDS had stationed a small tattooed man with a gun in there. It took a second for it to sink in that both crews had broken through. Finally, in the sealed vault, the police uncovered the kind of evidence about which I had only fantasized. Volumes of documents and marriage records, computer disks and hard drives, audio recordings and flash drives loaded with dictations by Jeffs in his own voice. It apparently was being kept secure in the underground bunker until the temple vault was completely ready and dedicated. And that cache of documents was the daily priesthood record of the prophet Warren Steed Jeffs, containing evidence that would almost certainly keep Uncle Warren behind bars for the rest of his life and lead to the incarceration of many of his lieutenants as well. Ferreted away behind those thick walls were the detailed day-to-day chronicles of his actions since first proclaiming himself prophet in 2002. Including admissions of numerous despicable crimes. Now, those crimes would be revealed to the world. By the time the searches were complete, a total of 463 children would be removed from the Yearning for Zion Ranch, and a dozen men, including the jailed prophet, would face a wide range of criminal charges. TV news crews descended on Texas, and the small town of El Dorado was overrun with news satellite trucks broadcasting the event around the world. However, the real magnitude of what took place that week would barely be noticed by most of the world. A Waco or Jonestown had been averted. The combined efforts of law enforcement, social workers, and former members who understood the intricacies of the time bomb ticking away within the compound had skillfully avoided disaster. The patience and professionalism displayed by law enforcement and CPS social workers and investigators, the efforts of a former member to set aside the abuse she experienced at the hands of the FLDS leadership and persuade Merrill Jessup to stand down, and 100 other small details initiated by conscientious professionals on the scene, combined to avert a potential catastrophe on a scale the country had probably never seen before. Considering what the FLDS and its insane prophet are capable of, and the violent history of fundamental Mormonism, the real story was how a catastrophe resulting in loss of life was avoided. While the fringe media began to spin a story of government intrusion into the lives of a supposedly eccentric, unpopular religion, I breathed a silent sigh of relief that justice had prevailed and not one person had been hurt in the process. Throughout the raid, Gary and I continued working with Flora Jessup in Utah, listening to our mystery caller named Sarah, who was still insisting that she was in Short Creek. Flora was able to get the caller's phone number from the caller ID feature on her telephone, and I traced it to a Tennessee cell phone service provider. That did not guarantee finding any address, however. The number had been assigned to an over-the-counter disposable phone that could have been purchased almost anywhere. Then Sarah dropped a Short Creek address into one conversation, identifying it as a corner house. I knew the place. The following morning, I drove down to the creek to confirm it. Town records showed that it belonged to an FLDS member named Lauren Fisher. When Sarah called the next time, Flora worked that name into the conversation. Lauren Fisher is your father, isn't he, sweetheart? The girl was hushed for a moment, then began to weep. Am I in trouble? She asked. Am I going to be in trouble? She again carefully dodged all questions about her exact location and stymied our attempts to help her. Gary was getting nowhere on the legal side in Arizona because of the lack of evidence. Our attention and that of the entire nation turned to Texas. Our stubborn mystery caller, however, was not yet finished with any of us. Chapter 36 Backfire. The Texas rescue attempt at the YFZ compound left everybody unsteady. CPS had stumbled onto an enormous caseload at a single location. The parents and their children were entitled to mandatory hearings concerning the allegations, and statutory deadlines had to be met. Texas requires that a hearing be held not later than 14 days after a child is taken into custody. Now it was the court system's turn to be overwhelmed, and Judge Barbara Walther consolidated all 463 children into a single preliminary hearing in San Angelo on April 17, 2008. I needed to determine if any of our clients might be affected, particularly an FLDS refugee whose wife and children had been reassigned to another man by Warren. Clothing bearing the new father's name was found in the temple at the ranch, along with the wife and one daughter. The other daughter, a 13-year-old, was gone, and I feared she had already been given in a fake marriage to the man who had become her new father only a short time earlier. We never found her. She was another of the girls who have simply vanished deep into the FLDS culture. Back in Texas, I began meeting with many of the people who had been involved in the rescue attempt. Among them was Angie Voss, the Child Protective Services supervisor who had made the actual decision to take the kids away from the compound. Voss asked me to come by the CPS office for a question-and-answer session about the FLDS with a few of her coworkers. I was impressed by Voss and her ability to make tough calls. She was an experienced veteran who had encountered the most horrible kinds of abuse during her career, and prior to the YFZ raid, she thought that she had seen it all. When I arrived at the office, Angie introduced me to her colleagues, and we settled in for an informal chat. More people drifted in. Soon, about 50 people were crammed into the room. My impression was that until a couple of weeks earlier, they probably had not known the FLDS from horseshoes. Now they were scrambling to catch up and anxious to get help through the learning curve. They peppered me with questions. How does this peculiar religion work? Are they really Mormons? What about celestial marriages and being sealed for time? Why do the women act like robots? While giving them an overview of the world according to Warren Jeffs, I was able to pick up more information about what those beleaguered workers had faced at the ranch. They had gone out to find one specific child, the girl named Sarah Jessup. Once inside the compound, that original mission mushroomed as evidence was discovered of more child abuse. Underage girls had been placed in arranged connubial relationships with older men, having babies soon thereafter, and even younger girls were in danger of the same fate. One CPS worker told me that they had started to think, "Oh, crap, this could turn into a half-dozen kids." Then the number rose to 18 children who needed further investigation and protection. Eventually, the CPS team reached the astonishing conclusion that it was not just one girl at risk on the ranch, it was every kid there. I let the CPS workers know that I felt that in removing those 463 children from the ranch, they had made the only choice open to them. Come what may, they had been true to their responsibility to protect children ensnared in a predatory caste system. I explained to them that kids raised in the FLDS culture just don't stand a chance. That when a boy is born, he has only three options in life. Make a mistake and be abandoned by his parents. Become frustrated enough to eventually leave the religion and live out his life as a traitor. Or grow up to be a perpetrator of abuse. That to be born female promises a future just as dismal. She will either be an underage bride or will later be placed with a man without regard to love. Either way, it is probable that her children will grow up and continue the cycle of abuse, with her as their primary mentor. It was important for me to let the CPS people know that I had never met nor spoken with any FLDS woman who had not been abused in some form, not one. It definitely would have been easier to investigate just a single case at a time, but that had not been possible here because hundreds of children were involved. In my opinion, Angie Voss made the right call. You should feel fortunate that you have been given this opportunity to make a real difference in the lives of so many children, I told the workers at the San Angelo CPS office. After the meeting, a few of us adjourned to a smaller venue to continue the discussion. That was when I got my first clue that things might not be shaking out well within the Child Protective Services Department. Two senior members of the department had been sent down from Houston, allegedly to help. But by the time our discussion broke up, I had the clear impression that they were really there to plan an exit strategy. The next day, I attended the hearing. The grounds of the Tom Green County Courthouse were carpeted with FLDS women in pastel prairie dresses and lawyers in suits. Few, if any, FLDS men attended, in order to avoid having to answer questions about their families and marital relationships. District Judge Barbara Walther would hear 21 hours of testimony that lasted over several days. Judge Walther ran a tight ship, but the situation bordered on chaos. One attorney would say something, then another would pop up to object, and within moments others would pile on with more objections and opinions. She needed the wisdom of Solomon, combined with a lion tamer's whip and chair. After weighing the evidence, the judge decided there was a significant risk of harm if the kids were returned to the YFZ ranch. So she ruled to keep all of them in protective custody while foolproof DNA tests were performed to establish parental relationships. All of the children would have to be individually evaluated before any decision could be made about returning them to their parents or placing them in foster care. I felt optimistic as I flew home. The justice machine had taken over, and it was out of my hands. They were going to have to find a solution, and the DNA testing was a good idea, at least in theory, although I knew the FLDS would fight it. The FLDS propaganda machine was furiously set in motion, with lawyers, mothers, and spokespeople talking about the impact that the horrible government's action was having on the poor children. The same parents who were performing for the cameras at these staged news conferences had willingly fed those same children into the abusive system of their church, saying nothing when Warren Jeffs chased away their sons and placed their underage daughters with aging men. There was no doubt the children were currently going through a tough time, and naturally they did not want to be separated from their mothers, but the decision could not be left up to them, nor swayed by emotion. On April 24th, there was startling news. A call came from an excited Flora Jessup. "You hear what happened?" Near my elbow, a producer for a major television network was also answering his phone, and his manner changed with each passing second. The police had found a woman by the name of Rosita Swinton in Colorado Springs, and the original calls to the crisis hotline were proving to have been a hoax. They took her down and questioned her, and no sooner had she gotten out, and she was calling me again and claiming she was Laura. Flora was baffled by the caller's nerve. She was either very bold or very sick. This was a game changer, not in the legal arena, but in the eyes of the general public. The FLDS was going to have a field day with this. The storyline was carefully manipulated by the former FLDS lawyer Rod Parker, who had been fired during the Lost Boys case, but was now brought in to handle the public relations situation at the ranch. He spoon-fed information to a couple of hand-selected FLDS apologist reporters, knowing that all it takes is a few people skilled with pens and television cameras to plant enough doubt to change the tide. FLDS mothers gushed horror stories about how the government was mistreating the crying children, some of whom were suffering from chickenpox and tummy aches. There were pictures galore. Until then, the media reports had been fairly sympathetic toward law enforcement. But with the new developments, an unlikely mix of radical constitutionalists, bigoted hate groups, and First Amendment defenders loudly protested what they perceived to be government mistreatment of the industrious Christian religious group and its children. The Texas governor and attorney general began to receive threatening letters and emails. I was asked to review some of them to see if I recognized the authors or origins. "What happened to religious freedom?" was the common theme. An email received by the governor's office warned Americans, "It's the Mormons this time, but it could be you next." They seldom mentioned the deviant prophet who had created the mess and was currently in prison for being an accomplice to sexually assaulting a child. There was also the looming issue of how much money the state of Texas was spending on the hundreds of cases. The financial pressure was growing severe. All of the workers, the emergency housing, the food, the overtime, and the unforeseen extras caused by having to deal with so many children and cases were blowing a hole in the budget. The overall price tag could run into the tens of millions. Things were simply happening too fast. The state was losing control. It was costing too much, and the PR field had been virtually lost to the FLDS spin doctors after Rosita's hoax was discovered. The case against Dale Barlow, the man who was alleged to have been the abusive husband of the non-existent Sarah, and therefore the second target of the raid, was dropped without comment. Only 6 weeks after the authorities breached the YFZ stronghold, I received a dismal email from a frustrated source in Austin who had been closely involved with the rescue attempt. "I don't think we can protect these kids much longer." The will to succeed was evaporating in the higher ranks of the bureaucracy. Within a few months, dozens of CPS workers, including those who had been involved in the raid, were fired, forced to retire, or reassigned because they would not agree to keep silent as directed by their superiors. At the end of May, Judge Walther's custody ruling was overturned by the Texas Third Court of Appeals. That court said there was no evidence of a clear and immediate danger to the children at the ranch and ruled that Walther essentially had mishandled the situation by rolling all of the cases into one. A week later, the Texas Supreme Court allowed the appeals court decision to stand. CPS would need to file each case individually in Walther's court and give the specific reasons why each child should be removed and placed in protective custody. Instead of going to that trouble and expense, CPS chose to begin quietly releasing the children, and Judge Walther had to vacate her ruling on custody. The result was a decisive win for the FLDS, and I watched in powerless fascination as they made the most of it. Big Willie Jessup, of all people, was now emerging as the chief public spokesman for the FLDS. Knowing his background as Warren Jeff's tough guy enforcer, I found it almost impossible to believe. He had not even been deemed saintly enough by Warren to be a temple worker, and had never been allowed on the temple grounds, but now he was the front man, all over television, playing the religious persecution card. Willie bragged among his people that he had learned his new skill of leadership at no less an institution than Harvard University. And that part was true. His former assistant explained to me that Willie had paid $4,000 for a week-long seminar at Harvard Law School on how to become a better negotiator. The Ivy League University runs such seminars regularly, but I had to wonder about the standards for being admitted to such a program. By shelling out big money for a 5-day course, Willie became a credentialed bullshitter with Harvard tacked behind his name. Willie held a news conference for the gathered national media in June and read a statement that promised the FLDS religion would no longer perform underage marriages in any place where they would be illegal. While that pledge appeared to acknowledge movement toward change, it was just more FLDS smoke and mirrors. Marrying children was already illegal throughout the country, as was polygamy. Furthermore, no FLDS member has ever had the legal authority to perform a marriage of any kind. I considered anything coming out of Willie's mouth to be suspect. Few reporters knew much about the religion's background. They did not realize that a vital underpinning of the church was utmost secrecy, and that lying to Gentiles was considered normal. After the lie, they would go back to doing whatever they wanted. It had been working in Arizona and Utah for many years, and it was working again in Texas. The press, however, did have some questions about this new spokesman. Was Willie the official church representative? Did his words reflect the actual policies of the church or its leadership? He dodged each point. To hear him tell it, he was just some guy handing out a news release. Whatever he said could be denied by the church hierarchy. Willie did not make any decisions without the approval of the prophet, and when asked if Warren had authorized the new policy of no more underage marriages, Willie had no comment. It was not long after this that I received a telephone call from Winston Blackmore in Canada. A 14-year-old girl had shown up unexpectedly at the home of her father, who is a Blackmore follower. The mother was a Warren Jeffs follower who had been reassigned to another man along with the children after the father had been expelled. The girl said she had run away from her mother's new household after being told that she was to be taken down to Short Creek and married to someone she had never seen. The cycle of child abuse continued. The fundamentalists had originally begun to rebel against the Mother Church in 1890 because of their refusal to recognize and obey the laws of the land. To cave in to the rule of law now would be to deny the principles upon which their religion was founded. Chapter 37. Sinking Ship. Judge Barbara Walther of the 51st District Court of Texas appeared undeterred by the reversal of the appeals courts, or by the complicated legal docket that she would have to navigate on both the civil and criminal sides of the looming behemoth FLDS situation. As a child in the 1950s, she was a victim of polio, which impaired her ability to walk. She still wears a leg brace. Out of earshot, the merciless FLDS apologist insultingly referred to her as the GIMP. She had been on the bench in West Texas for 16 years, and there was never any doubt about who was in charge of her courtroom. As the coming months unfolded, Judge Walther would prove more than capable of handling this avalanche of cases. But Schlaker County had neither the staff nor the resources to undertake such a monumental task of prosecution by itself and asked for state help. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott took charge of investigating the massive amount of evidence surfacing from the YFZ raid. Deputy Attorney General Eric Nichols was appointed lead prosecutor, and at his side would be the highly experienced Angela Goodwin, who was not only a veteran deputy attorney general, but was also a special assistant U.S. attorney. The difference between the aggressive law enforcement officials and the bureaucrats handling the civil side of the matter was startling. The Texas Department of Public Safety and Attorney General Abbott wanted to put criminals in prison for crimes against children. In contrast, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services and the CPS flip-flopped and seemed just to want to rid themselves of the untidy mess. The DNA testing ordered by the judge was a prime example. It was logical to positively identify the parents before handing a kid back. There was no other reliable way to establish family relationships within the insular cult. Both mother and father would have to furnish a DNA sample and prove parentage before being allowed custody. A mobile lab was set up to collect the samples free of charge. Beyond the DNA match, a positive form of identification would be required before a child went back under parental custody. In retrospect, it is difficult to determine who disliked the idea more, the FLDS Church or the state's unenthusiastic Family Services Department and the new CPS team. All of them basically ignored or went around the order. The church found a loophole. Only a handful of men showed up at the mobile lab to try to reclaim their children, and most of them were among those who had been kicked out of the religion but had remained loyal. Church leaders persuaded some of them that this was an opportunity to prove that they were, perhaps, worthy of being reinstated. Just convince the authorities that they were the real fathers with ironclad DNA matches. They would promise the state that they would henceforth provide a good home for the very children they had been ordered to abandon earlier at the command of the prophet. Once given custody, the fathers could simply return their children to the abusers. Nothing would change. Beyond that, the state agency with the responsibility for protecting children was practically releasing them into the wild. Instead of waiting for the DNA tests, the CPS began handing the children over to almost anyone who showed up with an ID and signed for them. Mother, father, brother, neighbor, total stranger, or group of strangers. The CPS's own release manifest would reveal that nearly 20% of the children taken in the rescue attempt were released to people other than their parents. More than a dozen names were in a column entitled, "Not Listed," which meant that the agency did not know to whom the children had been given. At least two children were released to Seth Jeffs, the prophet's trusted brother, a courier who trafficked young brides for the prophet, and who had also been arrested for soliciting prostitution with another man while on a road trip to deliver money to Warren. Seth Jeffs tried a tactic commonly used by FLDS members to confuse Gentiles by giving his middle name, Steed, in place of his true surname of Jeffs, but he was caught in the act. He was a convicted felon on federal probation and had lied to the CPS about his real name, and he got the kids anyway. It was incomprehensible. The real reason behind the bizarre CPS actions appears to have been costs. The investigation alone had cost $13 million, and estimates for integrating all of the children into mainstream society had ballooned to somewhere around $1 billion. Attorneys, expert witnesses, foster care homes, additional CPS workers, and other required support services would be very expensive and seem to have no top end. Texas Governor Rick Perry was in France on a week-long European economic junket when word came of the Texas Supreme Court's decision to reverse the Walther ruling. Perry responded with a strong endorsement of the sweep of the YFZ ranch. "I am substantially less interested in these fine legal lines that we're discussing than I am about these children's welfare." That was great to hear. "I still think that the state of Texas has an obligation to young women who are forced into marriage and underage sex to protect them. That's my bottom line," the governor stated. He warned the FLDS that he would not tolerate the sexual abuse of children in his state. "If you're going to conduct yourself that way, we're going to prosecute you. If you don't want to be prosecuted for those activities, then maybe Texas is not the place you need to consider calling home." Governor Perry issued that statement on June 6th, after which he flew from France to Sweden. Willie Jessup called the governor's remarks shocking and outrageous, and added, "Mr. Perry ought to get his facts straight." Little more was heard from the governor concerning the FLDS. The Department of Family and Protective Services decided to bring aboard its own version of a special prosecutor, and on July 21st hired Charles Childress, whose reputation in Texas as a leading family law expert was beyond reproach. As a professor and consultant, Charlie had been instrumental in writing many child protection and family laws. If he could straighten things out, then perhaps the TDFPS and its overwhelmed CPS division could ride his coattails back to respectability. Charlie was semi-retired and lived in Austin, meaning he would have to commute to San Angelo, and he did not really want the job. But old friends pressured him, and Charlie took the assignment because he thought he could do some good. What he found boggled the veteran attorney's conscience. He later summed it up for journalist Katie Vine of Texas Monthly magazine. Going up to the governor, none of them had any idea what was going on. They had no clue. In contrast, the attorney general's office knew exactly where it was going, and after sifting through the mountains of material seized at the ranch, a grand jury was impaneled in Schlaker County in July to hear the findings. For the first time, regular Texans, the citizens of the county, and the neighbors of the FLDS were given the opportunity to see behind the false fronts of piety and godliness. After Deputy Attorneys General Nichols and Goodwin presented abundant proof of abuse, the grand jury dropped a heavy hammer. Warren Jeffs and four other FLDS men were indicted with first-degree felony counts for sexual assault of a child. Raymond Merrill Jessup, age 36, his brother Merrill Leroy Jessup, age 33, Michael George Emack, age 57, and Alan Eugene Keat, age 56, all surrendered and were jailed. Jeffs remained locked up in Arizona. It was a clear message that the Texans were not being taken in by the expensive FLDS lawyers or the public relations spin doctors. Within 2 months, the grand jury handed down indictments on another three FLDS men on similar charges. Abraham Harker Jeffs, age 37, Lehi Barlow Jeffs, also known as Lehi Barlow Allred, age 29, and Keith William Dutson, age 23. That brought the total to 8 men indicted on criminal charges so far, based in part upon evidence gathered at the YFZ compound. Ironically, it was the identical number that Arizona grand jurors had handed down in separate cases earlier. No matter the success of law enforcement in going after the perpetrators of abuse, Texas CPS and its parent agency still wanted out. By the middle of August, they were dumping cases post-haste. In agency terminology, it was called non-suiting, which was doublespeak for no further investigation required. According to a department official, the non-suits could be because the children are in a protected environment or are over 18. It could be that we found no abuse or neglect. The standard could not have been set much lower. A parent or guardian and the child had to take a brief parenting and victim awareness course and then sign a paper promising to keep the children safe. That was it. CPS still had not even determined the true parents through the DNA tests. It was like rescuing a kid from the home of heroin addicts who have been selling their child for sex, then having mom and dad attend a seminar and promise not to do it again before sending the boy or girl right back into the dope and sex mill. The drama of a teenager named Teresa Steed illustrated how out of whack the process had become. At 14, Teresa had been assigned as an underage plural wife to Nathan Carter Jessup, yet another son of the influential bishop Merrill Jessup. She became pregnant at 15 and was about 7 months along when she was taken into protective custody during the YFZ rescue attempt. During that time, she had turned 16. She gave birth within days of leaving state custody. When CPS started sending children back to their abusers without regard to the potential consequences, Teresa Steed became a stumbling block. To the Texas Rangers, her situation was an out-and-out criminal act that could not be ignored, swept under the table, or non-suited. The Rangers wanted to interview the girl and obtain the baby's DNA to establish paternity. CPS would not cooperate and refused to reveal Teresa's location. Nathan Jessup, the suspected father, was nowhere to be found. A summons was issued for Teresa and the baby to appear before Judge Walther. Teresa showed up but did not bring the child, and when Walther asked where the infant was, the girl replied, "I'm not telling you." Walther sternly warned her lawyers to resolve the problem and meet the court's requirements. A peculiar sweetheart deal was brokered between CPS and Willie Jessup, who is not a relative, lawyer, social worker, or officer of the court, and whose involvement was irresponsible at best, in which the baby would be presented at a special private meeting with CPS workers. The Texas Rangers were not invited and were not even permitted to know where the meeting would take place. The Rangers found the secret meeting place anyway and served a warrant to take a DNA sample from the baby that Teresa had brought to the rendezvous. The test proved conclusively that the infant was not hers. The FLDS had played the inept CPS by swapping babies so as not to implicate the father. The obstinate Teresa Steed, who took part in the charade, then also vanished. As of this writing, a warrant for her arrest is still in force. To the best of my knowledge, the perpetrator of the crime, Nathan Carter Jessup, has not been taken to task due to lack of evidence. In October, I had begun a 3-day drive home from Texas when I received a call from Charlie Childress, who by then was in the thick of the fight. As he went through Warren Jeff's descriptions and church records, he had been completely undone by the extent of the abuse as a systemic problem. My name had come up for Childress as he reached out for people who could help bring him up to speed on the complicated FLDS lifestyle. He wanted my views on a proposed budget and the names of experts he could bring in as cultural translators. Childress believed the only hope for the FLDS children was to take a hard line, just as the lawmen were doing by going after the perpetrators. But his higher-ups wanted an impossible guarantee of victory if any trials were held in years to come. As any good attorney would do, Charlie refused to make such an impossible promise. I spoke to him again later that night about witness availability and organizing the needed budget, and I headed out again the next morning for Utah, somewhat upbeat that perhaps the game was not over after all. Childress had the sound of a man who wanted to take it all the way. By the time I turned into my driveway the following day, I received another call. Charlie Childress had submitted his plan to the bosses, handed them the budget, outlined his plan, and had been rebuffed. They had pulled the rug out from under him. Within a week, he submitted his resignation, retired again, and was gone. We never spoke again. Childress was replaced by his deputy, Jeff Schmidt, another excellent attorney, who replowed the same barren fields that Charlie had just tilled, and with the same result. I talked with Jeff frequently and gave him the same information. He talked to the same victims and witnesses, read the same reports and records, and came to the same conclusions. CPS again applied pressure. Schmidt also refused to budge. "Sam, when I took the job, I made a commitment to the CPS mission to protect children from abuse, neglect, and exploitation," he told me. "I just can't do what they are now asking me to do. I just can't do it." The Texas bureaucracy, not just the FLDS, had now become a foe, and there was only so much that any of us could do. Schmidt continued to disagree with his supervisors. He said a disk containing vital evidence came up missing from his desk. Schmidt also said a formal complaint to his superiors about his treatment was dismissed as quickly as it was filed. He was left with two stark options: do as he was told or get out. He transferred to the section dealing with elder affairs. Apparently, the people in charge of CPS had lost focus on the stated purpose of their agency, to protect children. Instead, it seemed that they were trying to save their own reputations and careers, and a lot of money. Some Texas legislators were now openly complaining that the price was too high. A final line of defense was the court-appointed special advocates, known as CASAs. trained volunteers who are assigned to work with attorneys and protect any child caught up in the system. CASAS act as third-party advocates to monitor a situation until children are completely safe. They don't care about politics or the media. They protect their charges fiercely, and heaven help anyone who gets in their way. Deborah Brown, the executive director of the Tom Green County Child Advocacy Center, wrote a carefully crafted letter of concern to Governor Perry on October 23, 2008, to put everyone on notice that the ship was sinking. She gave me a copy. Dear Governor Perry, CASA, or Court-Appointed Special Advocates, whose mission is to speak for the best interests of children, has staff and volunteers that have been involved with the FLDS situation in El Dorado since the attempted rescue of the children in April 2008. We have met the families, worked with the children in care as well as in their homes, and are appalled at the extent of the abuse to these children, emotionally as well as sexually. It is far more widespread than we could have ever imagined, yet Child Protective Services seems determined to sweep this case under the rug and call it quits. CPS recently non-suited most of the families and now only has 10 cases involving 37 children remaining. The original case total was 468 children. Please intercede on behalf of the children and help Child Protective Services validate their mission of protecting children. I visited the Yearning for Zion Ranch in El Dorado last Thursday and was amazed to see three new large buildings under construction. This indicates to me the sect is staying at the ranch and must feel that it is safe to carry on business as usual. There are literally dozens of young men from Utah and Arizona called the Lost Boys that have been forced to leave their homes within the FLDS community and turned out into the streets with no money, little education, and no knowledge of the real world simply for watching a movie or asking the wrong questions. We have many teenage girls aged 12 to 16 that are married or sealed to older men. Many of these girls have babies. We have met and visited with several men that were forced from their community for questioning the prophet. For this action, their wives and children have been reassigned to other men like property. Children have told us that they were taken from their mothers, given new mothers, and have not been allowed to see their biological mothers at all. The FLDS has claimed to have a wonderful homeschool program, but many of the children are testing below grade level by several years. We have a gold mine of information corroborating abuse of children and need to act upon it now, as we will never have this opportunity again. This situation is only going to get worse. By refusing to pursue these cases, Child Protective Services gives the impression to the public that no crimes or violations were discovered. This is absolutely incorrect. If we abandon these children because of fear of lawsuits or costs to our state, we are no better than the men who systematically sexually assaulted the young girls in the name of religion. This behavior has been unfettered in Utah because 50 years ago the state abdicated their authority and has been fearful ever since of taking on the FLDS. As Texans, we have historically supported the right cause no matter the pain or consequences. I think we can do no less in this cause for these children. Time is of the essence. Please do what is in the best interest of these children and intervene on their behalf. Don't let this problem become insurmountable on your watch as a leader of this great state. Instead of receiving help, Brown and her CASA volunteers were criticized by CPS officials. Brown later bitterly told reporter Paul Anthony of the San Angelo Standard-Times, "What the media says and what the public thinks is a zero in the equation. It should be what is in the best interests of the child. Who cares what Willie Jessup says? Who cares what Nancy Grace says? Who cares what anyone says?" The CPS spin was that their actual goal had been accomplished because the FLDS had learned the hard way that, by darn, you don't mess with Texas. From now on, those people at the ranch knew the state would be watching, and Willie Jessup had promised that the FLDS would stop underage marriages. It was a naive and self-serving position. The FLDS had not changed and had no intention of doing so. All that CPS had accomplished was to teach the FLDS how to fine-tune their crimes in order to better escape detection in the future. Chapter 38. Stalker. As dispirited as I was over the inability of the Texas DFPS to protect the children from future abuse within the FLDS, I was heartened by the justice being meted out to some of the perpetrators. The grand jury was changing the complexion of the overall case. I was particularly pleased when November brought four more indictments, this time including two of the biggest names in the breakaway religious cult. 68-year-old Wendell Loy Nielsen, the first counselor of the prophet, and Frederick Merrill Jessup, 72, the second counselor and the bishop at the YFZ Ranch. With Warren Jeffs already in jail, that meant that the entire ruling First Presidency was now under indictment, thus emasculating the FLDS leadership. Their trials are pending. Child Protective Services continued non-suiting the victims until all of the children but one were back with their FLDS parents, mostly at the ranch. It seemed fittingly symbolic that the last child standing was Marianne Jessup Jeffs, the redhead girl whom Warren had married only a few weeks before he was arrested 2 years earlier, when she was a mere 12 years old. She had been part of the three-bride ritual on Thursday, July 27, 2006, at the ranch in Texas, when the leadership had locked their fates together. All of the men involved in that extraordinary triple ceremony had been swept up by the law. Of the three grooms, Warren Jeffs was already doing his prison stretch on the Utah charges and was facing more charges in Arizona and Texas, as well as federal fugitive charges. Raymond Merrill Jessup and Merrill Leroy Jessup were later tried and convicted of sexual assault of a child and received 10 years and 75 years, respectively, in the Texas State Prison. The remaining two men involved, fathers of a pair of the brides, were Wendell Nielsen and Merrill Jessup, both of whom had been named in the largest grand jury bills. All were charged with serious felonies. Marianne was a different story. When she was taken during the raid, evidence was discovered that suggested she may have already become a mother herself at the age of 12. She would spend several months in a state-monitored foster home, but she was still within the control of the FLDS. In her pocket was a cell phone with which her mother, the ferocious Barbara Jessup, secretly text-messaged advice about how to obstruct the questioners and frustrate her foster parents. "Please stay angry," read one, while another instructed, "We need you to keep crying, pout, sleep in. Crying will get you what you want." When the state's workers tried to interview her and determine a course of action for her future, they found the girl had been transformed from a milkmaid waif into a spitfire defender of the faith. "She was a real little brat," one told me. Marianne plopped herself in a big overstuffed chair while being evaluated, was flippant and rude, and played the familiar answer-them-nothing card of her jailed husband, Warren, to the hilt. There was no doubt that she had been well-coached on how to take control of an interview. Then one of the workers handed her a photograph showing a red-haired baby that looked just like her, and asked whose child it was. Marianne grasped the picture and stared at it hard. She got up, walked unsteadily around the large chair, curled into a fetal position on the floor behind it, and began to weep uncontrollably, rocking back and forth as if she were having a nervous breakdown. She went from being a smart-mouthed child bride to being a sobbing mess in a heartbeat. This time, it wasn't an act. It was eerily reminiscent of the pain of a mother unable to turn off her love for her child. Such was the legacy that Warren Jeffs bestowed on the children he chose as concubines. The CPS finally gave up on Marianne, too. Once again, they brokered a deal with Willie Jessup and assigned her to a foster home, one within the FLDS, and with the usual sort of history that goes along with those beliefs. A 21-page report entitled El Dorado Investigation, Reviewing the Eventful Year of 2008, was released soon thereafter by the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. It stated that a total of 439 children had been removed from the YFZ ranch, and that 274 of them, from 91 families, had been the subjects of abuse and neglect. One in four prepubescent girls was involved in an underage marriage. That CPS